We have a number of issues before us, so we want to get rolling on. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3162, and Patrick, you want to give us a rundown on that, please?
Chair, I'd be glad to. House Bill 3162 directs the legislative administrator to establish and maintain high-tech hall of fame within the state capitol.
Okay, Representative Kitts, would you like to go around to the testimony table and tell us what you want to tell us?
I'll read my testimony
instead. On script.
That might be a good idea. Otherwise,
I cracked myself up. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Derek Kitts, State Representative for House District 30. Thanks for hearing this bill today. This bill was brought to me at the request of Associated Oregon Industries, and I was more than happy to submit the bill under my name as it relates to the high-tech industry and a high-tech Hall of Fame. Over 190,000 visitors come to the Capitol every year, and our murals and furnishings reflect the traditional natural resource industries of timber, ranching, and fishing, etc., which make Oregon's heritage so great. But I would submit to the committee today that the high-tech industry has been so prevalent in our economy and been such a backbone to the economy over the last 10 years, 20 years, and been such a strong source of an economic engine for our state, statewide, not just for the Washington County area. According to the CyberStats 2002 report, Oregon has over 89,000 high-tech jobs. And I won't bore the committee with reading every bullet point here, but 66 of every 1,000 private sector workers in Oregon are employed by the high-tech firms. I just met with Intel this weekend, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, where I was pleased to learn that the average salary at Intel, which is the number one employer in my district, makes $98,000 a year. And the average high-tech job in Washington County, as defined by a high-tech job, make $77,000 a year. So these are sources of great income for our people of our great state, and I would encourage, I won't step on the testimony of Mr. Matthews and the rest of the people that are here today, but I would encourage the passage of this bill. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions for Representative Kitts?
As tempted as I am, Mr. Chair, I'll reserve my questions for later.
But remember, Representative Kitts would only want it if it's a great question and not if it's a good question.
He told me it had to be an excellent question.
Oh, okay.
I would have an excellent response.
I have several.
I didn't realize. You didn't realize what the hurdle was.
It's only great questions, so we... No.
Representative Nelson?
Well, I'm just wondering, is there a fiscal
No fiscal statement has been received yet by us,
Mr. Chair. And well, does this mean that this is something that will be done by private corporations like Intel will fund this and so forth?
That's a very good question. Let's ask Representative Kitts and let him respond to that. Or is that a question that we should hold until Mr. Wade and Mr. Matthews?
Well, I think it is an excellent question, and I would defer to my excellent counsel when they testify.
Okay. Okay. Let's go ahead and hold off then. Hold that question, if you would, Representative. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. Can I bring you all up as a group? Harvey Matthews, Larry Wade, and Peter Mackey. And however you want to, looks like we need to bring the lights down a little bit. If anybody is caught snoozing, we will have a money jar up here, so no snoozing allowed.
Morning, Chair Crummell, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the hearing this bill. I have a short PowerPoint presentation I'll just run through, and I'll hand this over to my colleagues here. The importance of a Capitol building is seen not only by what's in it, but the quality of what's in it. And so I have a couple of things here. We have over 190,000 people, as Representative Kitts testify, this number is growing. People want to be more involved with their government. I think since September 11th, they're also traveling more domestically. And certainly our number of special sessions has encouraged people to come here. And when they do come here, what do they learn about our current economy? Several of the murals that we have are excellent. They provide historical background as to what built our fine state. Fishing, agriculture, forestry.
Grain.
Yes. So they leave here thinking, well, Oregon is pretty much a mining or shepherding, fishing, forestry, agriculture, ranching, or dairy state. And as I said, that is a proud, rich heritage that we have. But we do have almost 90,000 high-tech workers. We are ranked 20th in the nation in that capacity. We have 31,500 jobs that were added, which was high above the national norm between 95 and 2001. We have 66 of every 1,000 private sector workers are in high-tech, and high-tech exports represent 45% of Oregon's overall exports. And we're also nationally ranked in several capacities. So as we look at our capital itself, I would just ask you to look at with fresh eyes as a visitor coming into this state. What do you want it to project? What do you want people to go away from this state thinking about our economy, our people, where what our future is? And I think the building itself has the capacity to advertise, to share to the rest of the nation and the world about our state. So I encourage you to pass House Bill 3162 to that degree. Thank you. And with that, I'll introduce Larry Wade from the Software Association of Oregon.
Yes, Chairman Krummel and representatives, my name is Larry Wade. For the record, I'm president and executive director of the Software Association of Oregon. We're a nonprofit trade association that was formed 14 years ago with key industry funds from the Oregon Economic Development Department at the time. We have 637 member companies and represent an employment base of upwards of 20,000 people, much of that, of course, indirectly. We have a staff of five, a board of directors of 30, and about 100 volunteers that put on 50 programs, run insurance programs, and run four chapters across the state of Oregon. We're part of a national set of associations in every state, mainly sometimes so many per state, that represent high-tech and software industries. And I get to see twice a year in three-day conferences what other states are doing to develop and recognize their high-tech industry. And we have a lot to be proud of in Oregon, but I think we are a silent story. And I'm trying to figure out various ways to help communicate that story so that we can appreciate what we have here and be proud of it. This idea came from a meeting I had in January where the state of Utah created a Utah High-Tech Hall of Fame. And the last two pages of the handout describe a little bit about their press release and what they did. Using private funds, which is what's proposed here, so that the economic impact to the state government would be minuscule, that this would be a industry-driven, industry-funded project. In their case, they spent $60,000 to create a wood-paneled place in the rotunda of their state capitol in order to institutionalize people and organizations that they've elected into their Hall of Fame. In their site, it was 30 feet by 30 feet, a large monument. You know, I'm not conceptualizing that at all here. I would like to learn from that experience and learn from what they did in San Jose, which is to create a virtual web-based only project that they call the Visionaries Project, which they do on an annual basis. And the concept for that I would have and propose here is that we have both a physical Hall of Fame with a physical presence in the state capitol, but a modest physical space, probably kiosk-based instead of wood-based, not panel, not static, but touchscreen, and using the technologies that we have in Oregon that would both showcase what we have in the form of panel display manufacturers, but also the content that can be participative and interactive. In the handout, I listed several bullets that sort of summarize my concept. And I want to emphasize this is a concept at this stage. It is not a concrete proposal. We're seeking your support and endorsement, both as encouragement and as motivation to organize other peer groups around the in other sectors of the industry to put this together. And I want to emphasize that in what I would propose is this is not an attempt to get disproportionate recognition for the high-tech industry. We are one of many strengths in Oregon. We're just one of many, and I'd like to have this be recognized for the strength that it is, but not at the expense of other sectors of the economy that are very important. I think it's important that we do have representative acknowledgement. I just want to make a parenthetical point because there's another idea unrelated to this bill, which is a story told by the Oregon Blue Book. If you look at the Blue Book, which is one of the ways we tell the stories about Oregon, you have to really dig hard to find the paragraph about high tech buried in the manufacturing section and to find the two sentences representing the software industry in the state. It's disproportionate, and we're going to be working in parallel through other avenues to try to improve that storytelling capability as well, because that's just another example. My colleague Pete Mackey is former president and chairman of the board of the Software Association. I've asked him to talk a little bit about the software industry itself because in from my perspective, it's a hidden story and one that's not very well known.
Okay, thank you. I spent the early part of my high-tech career at Tektronix for a couple of decades, and in 1977, when I saw the software industry coming, I left a very responsible position and started my own company, which is 25 years and still going. The interesting thing about the revenue all those years is that some 99% of it has come from out of state. So the work, the value add that we create here, which is to write software and develop and publish it or license it to people like Motorola, Associated Press, Microsoft, Apple Computer. My company was started 25 years ago with two people, and today it's two people. And that's by design and by lifestyle, and it's my wife and I. And so a lot of us are very successful and kind of invisible. And one of the things we have that our industry is working on is we find a lot of small companies, and then we find a lot of the visible larger companies like Mentor Graphics and Tektronix and Hewlett-Packard and, of course, Intel. And one of the things that we're starting to work on is to see if we can get some more middle-sized companies, the 500,000 and 2,000. You might ask, why don't those happen? Well, what happens is the little companies get funded by the venture capitalists, and the venture capitalists justifiably are looking for a return, and so those companies typically don't go public. They sell up or sell out. And that's one of the dilemmas we have is we don't have very many middle-sized companies. And for our industry people, there are people that prefer to work in that segment. They don't want the startup, and they don't want the politics of the large enterprise, and there's nothing for them in the middle. One of the things that the Software Association is working on is clustering of our industry. And We're trying to figure out industry segments that we can cluster around, and we have three different committees going now related to those segments, and those are the IT sector, and that's the people in the back room of every large organization that are running all the data processing. And then another thing, we've given it a name. We call it invisible software, and that's the embedded software, which is inside of all the toasters. I have a car, and I've been told that car has some 60 different computers in it, and those computers require software. Well, a lot of that embedded software is developed here, or the tools to develop that. And then we have what we call the visible software, and those are the packages that you might go into a Costco or a computer store and buy. We sometimes think of it as packaged software. So those were the three segments that we're starting to work clustering on. And we have another cluster pretty well active, and that's called Oregon RAINS, and that stands for Regional Alliance for Internet and Network Security. And they have their own website, and I encourage you to look at it. And they're into cybersecurity and have made enough connections that when they now go to back to Washington, D.C., they can get meetings with our two senators. And our senators are working to fund that. And so there's an interesting one. Another one that is also just starting is medical informatics. And the immediate need there is the HIPAA thing and all of that. And there's 12 invisible companies working to put that cluster together today. And I think one of the stories that we would like to tell about the industry is just some of these things that are going on and get recognition so that there's help for those companies to grow big. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for anyone on our panel? Was I seeing your hand up, Representative?
Yes, sir. Representative Nelson? Question you asked.
Oh, yes, the question that you asked earlier. If you would go ahead and ask that again, please.
Thank you very much for being here, and I am proud of what you all have done. And we just need more and more jobs, so anything you can do. How will this be financed? Will the private companies pay for this Hall of Fame?
We think it will, Representative Nelson. It's my belief that it will be all privately funded.
All right.
We don't have commitments for that. We have some success in getting a wide range of sponsors to kick in for this. Some of it will be pro bono. Equipment donated by the display manufacturers and the labor donated to actually create the content. A much harder problem is not the funding, it's the actual criteria for who's going to be selected so that we don't trivialize the process, but really hold up the assets that we have that have international prominence and not just make it a low value process.
Just a follow-up, please.
A follow-up?
Yes, I appreciate that, and that makes me really proud of y'all. Now, space-wise, what is your requirement?
We need to discuss that because I don't really know physically for sure. My expectation is that it will be kiosk-based, and a kiosk is a touchscreen panel display about 3 feet by 5 feet, about 3 feet wide by about 5 feet tall, bordered by stainless steel pillars that's about 7 or 8 feet tall. This obviously can be customized. My expectation is that there'd be a few of those. And so if you would look at, you know, it would be maybe two of these widths of this witness table wide, be my guess. It could be collapsed into one. It could be semi-portable, so it doesn't have to be fixed and stationary. My hope would be that it would be interactive so that it doesn't end up behind glass, so people can't just statically do it. And by having a touch screen, it means there's a lot of content that users can get access to dynamically without having to have a dedicated large amount of space.
Okay. Okay. Representative Przanski, you had a question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that this is a concept that you're working on. I'm wondering what, if any, steps have been taken with the legislative administrator or with the legislative fiscal facilities as to developing the concept and what type of input you've gotten, if any, from them as to how they perceive this could be carried out.
I have not engaged the legislative administrator at this point. I was waiting for this committee to take action before that conversation takes place. Thank you.
Okay. Are there other questions for this group? Okay. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that that's all I have on my sign-up list? Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 3162? Seeing that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3162. Okay. We will potentially come back to this. So what I'm going to do is move on then and open a public hearing on House Bill 3206. And would like to have Patrick give us a little rundown on this, on 3206, please.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3206 directs the State Fire Marshal to adopt a statewide urban confined space and structural collapse emergency response plan, directs the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, in consultation with the Fire Marshal, to appoint an urban search and rescue coordinator and specifies that position's duties. The bill directs the State Fire Marshal and the Director of Oregon Emergency Management to establish a state program for urban confined space and structural collapse emergency operations, authorizes chiefs of police to restrict access to urban search and rescue areas, and limits the ability of persons conducting urban search and rescue operations.
Okay. Let's see. Can I just have the three of you come up as a panel? Robert Garrison, Ken Murphy, and Ken Armstrong. Two Kens and a Robert. Sounds like a rock band.
A garage rock band, if you will, sir.
Daryl, Daryl, and Larry.
Yeah.
My other brother, Cam.
And whichever one of you wants to start, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Fire Marshal Robert Garrison. I'm here speaking today in support of House Bill 3206. Oregon is challenged by a significant number of urban search and rescue problems resulting either from earthquake, potentially from weather events, or from terrorist activities. There is what's called urban search and rescue, and the two items that you see in the bill, confined space and structural collapse, are a part of that highly specialized discipline. A number of fire departments in the state have recognized this problem and have worked to develop a response capability. They've done this at their own cost, and these are generally fairly small teams that can deal with collapsed buildings and confined space rescue problems. The challenge that we face is that any of these teams in any kind of a significant event would be quickly overwhelmed. What we need is the opportunity to coordinate those responses and bring urban search and rescue teams in from unaffected parts of the state to assist the jurisdiction that's been impacted by the event. House Bill 3206 will facilitate that coordination. It amends ORS 401, which is the emergency management statute, and provides for a task force that already exists, a mutual aid agreement that already exists in almost its final draft, and 3206, in recognizing the existence of this group, would permit seeking federal grants for equipment and training. As it presently stands, each of the fire departments that are involved in urban search and rescue activities have at their own expense acquired specialized equipment and provided specialized training for their teams, and they're prepared to respond and assist one another by virtue of the mutual aid agreement that's mentioned in the bill. But we need the opportunity to get more equipment, very expensive, very specialized equipment, and even more training. And recognizing the task force that exists through this bill will facilitate that. The task force that presently exists was organized about a year ago at the request of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. And it involves the chiefs of police, the sheriffs, the Department of Transportation, Oregon Emergency Management, and virtually all of the fire departments that are presently involved in urban search and rescue. So that's what we're attempting to do with this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to testify today. Certainly would request passage of this bill. There are some minor changes that have been proposed by the sheriffs, and we'll deal with those a little later on. Also here today is Ken Murphy. Ken is, as of today, the new director of Oregon Emergency Management, and he has also signed up to testify.
Well, congratulations. So what happened to, or maybe that's not something we should discuss publicly. Never mind. I don't. Hey, I just work here, man. I don't know what's going on.
Fast-moving world.
Yes, it is.
Chair Krummel and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy, and I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and I'm here also to testify in favor and support of House Bill 3206. As Mr. Garrison has mentioned, urban search and rescue is a very highly specialized type of rescue that not everyone is capable or trained of doing. And as we go through emergencies, whether it is earthquakes, floods, terrorism, landslides, different types of confined space rescue or collapse of buildings, tunnels, bridges, and those type of things do require some very specialized and some quick-acting personnel to be able to save people that are trapped. The mortality rate of people that are trapped in these type of circumstances, based upon the weather and the conditions and possibility of hazardous materials that could be involved, can be very few hours or, you know, longer where people are actually able to survive. And by the passage of this, it gives Oregon a capability that we really don't have significantly, and to use it throughout the state, I think, would be a great asset to the citizens of the state. And as you may be aware or not, the Federal Emergency Management does have urban search and rescue teams around the nation, but you cannot just call them up and have them arrive. It does declare or require presidential declaration or in some unusual circumstances. And so, and they're, the closest one is in Seattle, Washington, and so it's not easily attainable if we had some sort of small rescue effort in Oregon. And so this concept is not new. I think it's been a real tribute to the fire service and the sheriffs and everyone involved in the public safety community. We've been working on this for a year plus to put it together, and I think it will be a great asset to the state if approved, and will ensure just one more capability for Oregon to protect its citizens. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Please. Mr. Chair, if I may add just one thing. Battalion Chief Ed Fitzgerald from Portland Fire and Rescue is here, and he directs the technical rescue team for the City of Portland. I don't believe he signed up to testify, but if there are any questions relative to this very specialized discipline, Chief Fitzgerald is here to assist with answering those questions.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, and also Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. Just to kind of wrap up a little bit, the situation is, of course, as we all know, we live in a different world than we did a couple of years ago. And when it was brought to our attention from the Fire Marshal, Bob Garrison, that there were some fixes that need to be made to statute to make sure that the state of Oregon and our emergency response personnel were able to respond to these kinds of disasters that deal with confined space and structural collapse, we jumped on it to make sure that we had a bill in there that was going to take care of that issue. This is an important addition to statute to make sure that Oregon's fire and life safety, that law enforcement are all prepared to do what's necessary to save Oregon lives and also property. We encourage you to support this bill, to move it onto the floor. We are aware that there are some amendments that need to be made, a couple from the sheriffs, and then also legislative council brought to our attention one issue that needs to be looked at and tweaked a little bit more relative to some of the liability issues. And I believe Chris Crane from legislative council is here if you're interested in hearing a briefing on what that is. So the nutshell is we have a couple of amendments that need to be dealt with on this, and then we're looking forward to seeing this be able to move out. We're not aware of anybody that's got any problems or concerns with it. We think it's a good bill, and we hope that you'll concur.
Okay, great. Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Mabry.
Out of sheer ignorance and being so new to the process, I'm not sure what is defined as urban, but I'm wondering if this has any impact on local communities, any unintended impact for having to do a plan or something in beautiful downtown Shanico or somewhere.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I don't think that's going to be the case. We make a distinction of urban search and rescue as opposed to wilderness search and rescue. Wilderness search and rescue obviously is the purview of the sheriffs primarily in this state. They do that very well. They're not trained up for those issues that deal with collapsed structures, and we're generally talking about very large structures. Could be a freeway overpass, could be a building. There's any number of them. But smaller communities, no community is being tasked with writing a plan here anyway. The bill calls for Oregon Emergency Management and the Office of State Fire Marshal to do that. We, in effect, very nearly have that plan already in our fire service mobilization plan, and it'll be a fairly simple matter for us to add a small addendum to add urban search and rescue, again, specifically in this case for confined space and structural collapse, to that mobilization plan, and we're on our way.
Okay. Other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you very much, and congratulations, and I appreciate all that you all do. I have concerns from my constituents on what this, that this usurps the local fire marshal's responsibility as they now know them. Can you give them some support? I don't see how we're working with local. I don't see that anywhere, local fire marshals.
Mr. Chair,
included in the bill, I don't see.
Representative Nelson, they're actually not included in the bill. Typically, the role of a fire marshal is fire prevention. They do code adoption, code enforcement, and fire investigation within their jurisdiction. And that certainly is a traditional role of the Office of State Fire Marshal. But because of our statewide responsibilities, we carry out into some operational matters. For instance, we mobilize fire departments at the governor's direction on large fires, on conflagrations, and we've been doing more and more of that each year. That's not something that involves local fire marshals. Within the jurisdictions that have technical rescue capabilities, they're not an assignment of the fire marshal. They are assigned typically to what we'll describe as the operations chief, who's sort of a counterpart to the fire marshal. So you're correct in that local fire marshals are not mentioned in the bill, but they don't have a piece of these kind of operational technical rescue matters. We always involve the local fire service in everything that we do, whether it's the fire chiefs or the chiefs association or the fire marshals through their association or just through our deputy state fire marshals working with the local jurisdiction fire marshals. We would not exclude any of them that felt like they wanted to be involved in this, but we didn't identify the need to mention them in the bill.
Hold up, Mr. Chair.
Just a second, Mr. Armstrong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I might add that I don't know if the lobbyist for the Fire Marshals Association is here in the room, but we could certainly get some feedback for you from those specific people. As Chief Garrison has said, from the local fire agency perspective, what the local fire marshal does is a very different thing from what the fire marshal's office does, and I think you'll find that individual jurisdictions, including their fire marshal, are going to be very supportive of what we're trying to get to here, which is providing greater coordination and liability coverage, et cetera, for dealing with these kinds of situations. But I'd be more than happy to try and get some feedback for you from the Fire Marshals Association if that would help you feel more comfortable.
Now follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And thank you very much. This would make have two no votes here on this from my constituents. So this would very much, I think, make them feel inclusive. And I'm going to encourage you to include all search and rescue, all fire marshals or fire chiefs in this. I think that's the way we can build this coalition that we need in our state for all responses, and I hope you consider it. And also, I would appreciate if you could include the coordination with private business, i.e., the ambulance companies, the construction companies, the helicopter companies, in this some way, so that this is not just a quote government function. I think to fight the terrorism and also to help in all needs that we've got to work together. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we have a search party out right now for the lobbyists for the Fire Marshals Association to have him. Yeah, the search party was successful. That was.
You guys are good.
Yeah.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Can we have him removed? Can't have him removed? It's a thought, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm members of the committee. I'm Burton Wiest, and I represent the Oregon Fire Marshals Association in Oregon. And as I understand it, the question was about the relationship with this bill and the local fire marshals in the local communities. Something that has historically caused us problems before is the state fire marshal actually is a different operation than local fire marshals. It's not a one-to-one relationship. And this bill, in fact, effectively has nothing to do with local fire marshals. This deals with an issue that's dealt with by the state fire marshal's office and is not related to issues of local fire marshals. So on this bill, we really didn't take a position because it didn't directly affect us. Okay.
So does that kind of answer your question, Representative, or your comments with regards to the local fire marshal issues that you were bringing up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could just make one remark to Ms. Cheese. For my district, because we're rural, mm-hmm. You know, this urban word just makes us crazy. And we like it to be all-inclusive. And I hope you'll take the time to ask these individuals if they'll include all us local yokels from the rural areas and make this an inclusive state action.
Chair Crummell, Representative Nelson, it is always a pleasure for me to give the state fire marshal a bad time, and I would be more than pleased to do that on your behalf. So, I appreciate being empowered.
We must be careful what we do from the dais.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I may, one more comment for Representative Nelson. Actually, the purpose of the bill is to involve the entire Oregon Fire Service. As it presently stands, urban search and rescue is limited to a handful of large jurisdictions in the state, Portland, Tualatin and Valley, Salem, Medford, and so on. The other fire departments, what we think of as the smaller rural fire departments, have neither the need nor the resources to develop an urban search and rescue capability. And what we're attempting to do with the bill is make those resources of those larger jurisdictions available to those smaller jurisdictions. When we have an event that qualifies as a disaster, the governor declares it to be so and authorizes mobilizing those resources. And what we've put together, we have done at the request of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, which certainly represents all the fire chiefs in the state. So we've attempted to be as inclusive as we possibly can.
Okay. Thank you. Chris, would you come up for a second, please? Go ahead and state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Crane from Deputy Legislative Counsel.
My question, Chris, is relative to the amendments that Mr. Armstrong spoke of. I guess, first of all, do you want to give us a real briefing about what those entail and when you think you might have those ready?
Chair Crummell, I'll try to be brief. And this is an issue that is... The members of the House and the Senate are going to face again and again this session in the coming years because of a case that was decided by the Oregon Supreme Court about a year and a half ago, Smothers versus Gresham storage or transit storage or something. The section in this bill, its last section, Section 6, deals with liability, was taken almost verbatim from an existing section in ORS in the Oregon Conflagration Act, 476-600. So we've got similar provisions already in law. And the problem, the keystone of the problem, is the section in the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, that says every person shall have a remedy for injury done to them in their person, property, or reputation. Leaving reputation aside for a moment, what do you do about that, but
what are you trying to say?
Yeah,
your reputation may be at stake here.
The expense of my reputation. There's been a long line of cases in Oregon going back almost to statehood that says when and person is injured by an act of the local government, you have to be able to, the person's got to have a remedy. So you could sue the local government or the employee who did cause the damage. Oregon created the Oregon Torts Claims Act and shielded the employees from liability. So those of you who may have been on elected local councils probably know that your employees are not liable for negligence, but you can sue the local government, and their liability is limited to the limits in the Torts Claims Act. So a person has the remedy. So the first section, first sentence in Section 6 says that neither local government nor its agents or employees may be held liable for anything they do in implementing Sections 1 to 5 in this Act. Well, that's clearly a problem. If somebody's injured, they have to have a remedy. So our response to that is to probably take that sentence out and leave the current liability system in place, which means then that if a local fireman or other person responding to this emergency does something negligent, somebody's injured, the injured party would be able to sue the local government, and their recovery would be limited by the Torts Claims Act. The second sentence says that if a person is injured, the person who causes the injury is not liable unless the injury is caused by willful misconduct or gross negligence. So you can still recover for your injury, but it has to be caused by this higher threshold of willful misconduct or negligence. And this is something that's been in Oregon law for a long time, and it arose out of acts of the legislature back in really the 20s and the 30s, where the legislature adopted what are called guest passenger statutes or Good Samaritan statutes. And in that situation, the question was, if you get in a car with somebody and they're driving and they cause an accident and you're injured, can you sue them? And the legislature said, no. I mean, you took the ride, you voluntarily put yourself in that situation. You take your lumps. And the court went back and looked at Article 1, Section 10 and said, no, the person has to have a remedy. And they threw that law out as unconstitutional. So the legislature went back and took another shot at it and said, well, you can sue the driver, but only if what they did to cause the accident was gross negligent. If they just forgot to look left and entered the intersection and you got hurt, you know, kind of too bad. But if they were roaring drunk, weaving through town and caused an accident, then maybe you can sue them. So there was this two-level analysis. Ordinary negligence causes an injury, no problem. Gross negligence, you can sue them and recover. Well, in the Gresham, Smothers case a year and a half ago, it was a workers' comp case. And some of you may, if you've been dealing with the workers' comp issues, you know that you would only be able to recover for your injury. And I'm not a workers' comp lawyer. If there are any in the room, please don't shoot me in the back because I'll probably misstate this. But the law was that you could only recover for a workplace injury if it was the major contributing cause to your condition. If it was not, too bad. And the court said, no, I'm sorry, the person has an injury. They have to be able to recover under Article 1, Section 10. So there we had a two-level analysis, major contributing cause versus any contribution to the injury. And the court said that violates Article 1, Section 10. Well, the second sentence in Section 6 sets up that same kind of two-level analysis. You can only recover for your injury if it's caused by gross negligence, not ordinary negligence. And we have a real question whether or not the court would throw that out as unconstitutional, looking at what they did in the Smothers case. So, you know, after talking to Bob about this, it's a workers' comp case. It's analogous, but there's no cases directly on this. The Oregon laws, you know, there's 12 or 16 volumes of Oregon laws. They're just shot through with this kind of provision. It's a call that could go either way at this point, but our recommendation is to leave that sentence in and let the courts tell us if it's a problem. So the recommendation for Section 6 is to take out the first sentence and leave the second sentence in. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And that's as short as I could make it. Sorry.
That's okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Curring?
Oh, and as to the time, we could turn that amendment around as soon as we can do the other ones. So, and present them all to you in what time?
Okay. What I would like to do then is, and I would rather fix it over here as opposed to move it on and let the Senate fix it because they may figure out something else that they want to fix on it. So what I'd like to do is, if you can get together and figure out what the sheriff's amendments as well as the constitutional problem that you've identified, Chris. And then get those to Chris so that he can get them drafted up. Then what I'd like to be able to do is probably next Tuesday, I'd like to bring this back for a work session so we can kick it out of here. Okay?
Yes.
So with that, and you all understand the direction, I presume. Before I close the public hearing, is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3206? Seeing none, with that then, is there anything else that you all had? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3206, and as soon as we can get those amendments, we will bring it back for a work session. Okay? Thank you. With that then, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3136, and Patrick, would you give us a rundown on this bill, please?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3136 requires the Oregon State Boxing and Wrestling Commission to develop a plan to abolish the commission and to report that plan to the Legislative Assembly.
Okay, we have with us Representative Cliff Zahner. Representative Zahner, nice to have you here. Welcome to General Government.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and
always good morning.
To see you. Committee, I beg your indulgence. So I just got the amendments back yesterday, and I didn't know whether it was a boxing bill, a cockfighting bill, or my swan hunt. So I would ask you to, until I can work through it with the Legislative Council, I would just ask you just to keep the bill open and let me get back to you.
Okay.
Could you do that, Mr. Chair?
Okay. I appreciate that. I appreciate knowing that. And is that all you wanted to say?
That's it.
Okay.
That's what we can do until we straighten it out.
Are there any questions for Representative Zahner? Okay, great. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate that. I don't have anyone else on the list here who wants to testify, but is there anyone who would like to testify on House Bill 3136? Seeing none, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3136, and we will maybe see it in a new life later on. With that, then, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3581. And Patrick, would you give us a rundown on this one, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3581 eliminates state regulation of wrestling.
Okay. That was quick. Okay, we have with us Representative Tootie Smith. And Representative Smith, welcome to General Government. Nice to have you here. And why don't you go ahead and come on up, and you can tell us what you want to tell. Well, just tell us about the bill. Don't tell us what you want to tell us.
Okay. Well, those are two different things, as you might know.
Yes, that was pointed out to me earlier by Representative Kitts.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chairman and members of the General Government Committee. I present to you today House Bill 3581. 3581 deregulates the entertainment wrestling, and to put that business in line with what 48 other states are currently doing. Currently, the state of Oregon, entertainment wrestling is regulated like a sport. And that's an important distinction I want to make between entertainment and sport. Wrestling in this state is defined as competition between contestants who deliver blows and with the intent of punishing or hurting or immobilizing the opponent, with the opponent unable to finish a contest. This is nothing like what entertainment wrestling is. Entertainment wrestling is regulated in a manner currently in Oregon that makes it impossible for the industry to conduct business. We have the WWE, the World Wrestling Entertainment Corporation, wanting to come to Oregon. They have committed to 4 shows a year, with an economic impact to the state of Oregon of $15 million. With current direct revenue to the state of $96,000 and current direct revenue to the city of Portland of $96,000. Entertainment wrestling is defined as an exhibition or performance in which the participants deliver blows and apply holds with no intent to punish an opponent. Entertainment wrestling is distinguished by the fact that it is an exhibition and the performance is predetermined. Yes, folks, it's fake. Sorry, Derek.
I can't believe you would say that in a public. Yeah.
You tell me there's no Easter Bunny, I'm out of here.
Okay. No, I won't go that far. This new definition allows the state of Oregon to view wrestling as entertainment, not sport. With this new definition, Oregon will be open for business with the wrestling industry. There's two important aspects that must be recognized in this bill. First, the representative from the Oregon's Wrestling Commission will be testifying on behalf of this bill in support of it. along with a representative from WWE sitting to my right, as well as a representative from the Rose Garden. We've had the vice president of the Trailblazers, J.E. Isaac, who was in support of this bill at a previous news conference we held, and we also had representatives from WB32 Television who were also in support of this bill, and they will also derive revenues from this when the programs are televised. Secondly, this bill has broad support. We've got 24 different co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle, and I do have Senate support of this. In one closing statement, I'd like to say the Wrestling Commission will be allowed to issue a promoter's license for entertainment wrestling. And within the promoter's license, there will be provisions to keep wrestling safe for the wrestlers and the promoters, and most importantly, the fans. Do you have any questions?
Are there any questions for Representative Smith? Okay. I don't see any right now, so why don't you go ahead, sir, and then we can follow up with...
Thank you, Chairman Crummel, distinguished representatives. My name is Richard Herring. I am Vice President for Governmental Relations of World Wrestling Entertainment, and I appreciate the opportunity of having come this morning to support the bill that the representative has submitted. World Wrestling Entertainment is the predominant promoter of professional wrestling, as we call it, worldwide. Somewhere in the world, we are promoting two live events every day, and we have not been in the state of Oregon in almost 12 years. The reason for that is the existing rules of the commission prohibit us to do so. Some of the rules in your commission require us to have all of our wrestlers here 30 days in advance of the event for compliance with your rules and regulations. That is not done anywhere in the United States and would be cost prohibitive to fly, literally charter a plane to come up 30 days ahead of time. So it's made it impossible for us to do so. Wrestling, if I may say, and I think Representative Smith has brought this out, has basically come out of the closet. It is entertainment. It is not sport, as it would have been considered 20 years ago when some of these, or 30 years ago when these laws were made. It has done a 180, and we acknowledge that our events are rehearsed, that the outcomes are predetermined, and that it is strictly an entertainment event, and we treat it as such. It is a soap opera performed in an arena in front of a live audience rather than in a television studio on a closed set. And that's what we are. It's an entertainment event. It's televised events, pay-per-view events. We do 12 pay-per-view events a year. We do magazines. We do videos. And it's treated as such. The majority of major states have already recognized that it is entertainment, and in a vast majority of the states have actually removed the control from athletic commissions to other regulatory agencies such as departments of state for the promoter's license and the bond business regulation. But one of the interesting, I was the executive deputy commissioner and director of operations for the New York State Athletic Commission, and that's how I came to my job with them when I retired from the state. I was also one of the founding members of the Association of Boxing Commissions, which is our the National Association of Boxing Commissions. And one of the rules that we had, and I think it parallels one of the rules that you have here, is that as a regulatory body, athletic commissions should not be part of a sham or collusive act. Our rules had that in New York, and I used to say, well, how can we regulate something that we know is predetermined, the outcomes are pre-staged, and we're sitting there to regulate this event? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't belong within an athletic commission. if 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if you said to a wrestler, you know, is it fake, he'd probably put you in a headlock. Today, that's not the case. We acknowledge that it is entertainment events.
Wasn't there a news reporter that was put in a headlock? And
kind of many years ago, for asking the same question, John Stossel. Yes.
Yeah, John Stossel.
John Stossel, for asking that question.
Yeah.
I
don't think
D. David Schultz.
Yet.
Yeah, no, he hasn't. D. David Schultz. For those of the representatives who are not familiar, we just completed one of our pay-per-view events in Seattle, Washington, on Sunday. That was held at Safeco Field. It was the largest attendance ever for that facility. We had over 54,000 people in attendance. The pay-per-view event was shown in over 200 countries around the world on pay-per-view. And just to give you a little idea, as I said, we do 12 pay-per-view events a year, one a month. Our tax to the state of California for that event was approximately $140,000 for that one event in tax. We then did TV last night in Key Arena, and we're in Spokane, Washington tonight. For TV. We're doing 3 days direct in the state of Washington.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bobakian. I
wonder if your organization might be willing to pony up the money for a stadium that could be used for
Well, we could probably promote enough events in your state, that, and we would like to, that may add to at least the down payment for the stadium. Oregon has been for many years one of the locations that we do want to come into. Rose Quarter we've had ongoing dialogue with them. We have dates on hold already. In fact, May 31st, we put a date of hold on May 31st to try and come in. We've committed to do our live events in this state. We've committed to do our televised events in this state. We just need the opportunity to be able to do so. This bill would give us that opportunity. One of the questions, and I don't want to belabor it, but I may answer some of the questions that you may have, is, well, how do we control the safety of the wrestlers? We are no different than any other entertainment event that comes in. The safety of our wrestlers is paramount to us. After all, they wrestle tonight. They have to wrestle tomorrow night, and they have to wrestle the next night. There is absolutely no intent, and we go overboard to make sure that they don't hurt each other. We have our own team physicians that travel. We have our own medical exams. It is self-contained and self-sufficient because it has to be. They are entertainers who are also great athletes and great acrobats, if you want to use that word. There is no government regulation of acrobats from Ringling Brothers when they come into the state, and there shouldn't be of our association. So we would look for the opportunity to come in to the state and to provide what we do in every other state, and we hope you would consider the bill.
Thank you.
Okay.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, Stan Pulliam, I'm legislative assistant for Representative Smith. First, I saw it being handed right in front of you was a testimony statement. Jay Isaac, the senior vice president of Rose Garden Arena Corporation, was unable to make it today, but he did submit a statement in support of the bill. Obviously, the Rose Quarter has some invested interest in House Bill 3581. Second, you probably have seen some proposed amendments that have come forth on this bill, and I kind of would like to maybe give a short explanation of why that is.
That would be fine.
When we first came to the idea of developing House Bill 3581, we perhaps thought that it would be best to eliminate the wrestling regulation altogether from the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. Since then, it's been brought to my attention that if we did that, we'd come in conflict with Ultimate Fighting, which has somehow came under the provision of wrestling, which makes sense under the current definition of wrestling, two opponents trying to immobilize each other until one contestant cannot finish the match. As a result, we've introduced a new term, entertainment wrestling, And the definition within that is entertainment wrestling means a performance in which the participants deliver blows or apply holds with no intent to punish or immobilize an opponent. Entertainment wrestling is distinguished from boxing, extreme fighting, and wrestling by the fact that the outcome of the performance is predetermined. That's a definition that we developed with the promoters and with the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. Boxing and Wrestling Commission, I think it should also be stated that they will still handle the licensing of a promoter within their commission. And there's actually a statement in there that states that the promoter... let's see here.
You're talking about page 3 on line 14? Is that where you're looking for it? Promoter means a corporation, partnership, association, so on and so forth.
It defines that they'll hold a promoter's license, but actually, I'm looking at page 6, line 28.
All right.
Notwithstanding the grounds of suspension of a license under paragraph A of this subsection, the license of a promoter is an entertainment wrestling performance may be suspended if the license fails to provide the superintendent at least 10 days prior to the performance an affidavit that certifies that all participants who are going to participate in the entertainment wrestling performance are free of blood-borne pathogens.
Okay.
That was another agreement that was made with the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission to help ensure safety to the entertainers, to the promoters, and to the fans, of course. So I just wanted to draw your attention to the reasons for the amendments, and I believe all parties are aboard with these amendments.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Herring, would that be your have you had a chance to look at the amendments? Because basically what it is, it's a gut and stuff. So we would be removing everything from the bill that's currently in there and replacing it with the amendment. Is that...
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We certainly worked, and I'd like to, on the record, thank Stan for working with us as well as with the commission. He has done a lot of due diligence to make sure that the bill not only protected the commission, the fans of this state that would be in attendance, as well as working with us to ensure that we were in compliance with what would work, and we certainly are. I just want to reiterate that we do look out for our participants more so than a lot of other events possibly coming in. We have bloodborne blood pathogen programs in place. We have medical requirements in place. Our bloodborne pathogen program has been through OSHA. It's aggressive. We have our own doctors. When we do our TV events, we have doctors in attendance. So we monitor very, very strongly, as we have to. The other thing I would like to bring to your attention is that when we come to an area for our televised events, we use all local, either union stagehands through your local employment.
Actors Guild.
Yeah. Well, we hire just for TV. We probably bring in over 200 local people for rigging, staging. So the employment related to that, the ancillary part of that is the local effect, not only for people coming in the taxes, but the employment for a couple of days to try and get the staging up, the lighting up, the rigging, the sound, and so on.
Okay. It's good to know. Are there any questions for Representative Mabry? You have a question.
I do. The comment you made about reserving a date for May the impending problems with that, I did a very quick look, but I don't see an emergency clause. Is there an emergency clause?
Yes, I can address that, Chair Crummell and Representative Mabry. We originally wanted to put an emergency clause in this. However, I think that what can happen is through regulation, since the Wrestling Commission is willing to go along with what we want to do, that can be accomplished through regulation. The reason why we cannot have an emergency clause in this, because this in essence is a revenue-raising bill, because Since there are more shows scheduled, more money will be collected in the form of tax on the tickets, and it is not constitutional to have an emergency clause with revenue-raising measures.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
That was very interesting to me, too. So I think that if we want to, if they want to schedule a show for May 13th, we can do it through the regulatory process, not the legislative process.
My only question about that, Representative, is that through the under current statute, because this wouldn't take effect until January 1 of 2004.
Correct.
Under current statute, does the commission have the authority to change those?
Well, we will explore that. And Representative Crummell, I think they do, since these regulations came through administrative rule and not statute.
Okay.
So what I want to do is I want to show the Wrestling Commission that we have legislative intent to enact this, and therefore they can go to the upcoming legislation that will be enacted January of 2004 and say, hey, you know, we can do this.
Okay. Okay. Representative Nelson and then Representative Kitts. You didn't have a question, did you? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I think I don't understand all this, but in your testimony, you talk about the State Wrestling Commission. It was my understanding we were getting rid of the State Wrestling Commission.
The State Wrestling Commission will remain.
So we're going to have we're going to have two commissions now instead of one.
No, we have currently we have a boxing and wrestling commission that are combined.
We have one.
Yeah, we have one that'll stay that way. No, it'll still stay the way it is.
Chairman Crummell, Representative Nelson, if I may.
It
still exists, the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. There's just one new item that will fall under their jurisdiction, for they'll be issuing a promoter's license.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is we're getting them out of the entertainment wrestling portion of the regulation and just allowing them to issue a promoter's license.
Right.
So the only one commission.
Well,
follow up.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My notes here say we would remove wrestling from the Boxing and Wrestling Commission's purview and rename the organization the Oregon Boxing Commission. Is that true or false?
Representative Nelson, I can clarify that the original bill would do that. The -1 amendments don't remove that provision of the name change of the organization. And so the staff measure summary, which you have before you, was written before the before I received the -1 amendments. And so that provision, the name change of the organization, does not take place with the -1 amendments.
So then, just to clarify this, Mr. Chair.
Clarification.
So in Representative Smith's testimony, where you say the State Wrestling Commission will be allowed to issue a promoter's license, what you really mean is the State Boxing and Wrestling Commission will. Is that right? So we're not getting rid of...
That is correct, Representative Nelson.
Okay.
Okay.
And final question is...
final question?
Yes, on the Native American issue of their having these events at their casinos.
I don't address that anywhere in this legislation. And I'm not prepared to talk about or represent the Native American interests.
Well, my question is, does this commission still, does it have governance over contests if Mr. Herring would have WWE and his...
The Native American community is a sovereign nation and regulates itself.
I think I think Representative, we would probably need a statement from Legislative Council about that, because, for example, at the Grand Ronde facility, that's on sovereign land, and the Native Americans are. That tribe is a sovereign tribe, in other words, so they can regulate themselves. And I don't know if, irrespective of state law, if they wanted to promote something out at the casino, they potentially could do that. So for that, we would need to have council come in and let us know.
Important to my community.
Okay.
Chairman Kremel, Representative Nelson, also Captain Bob Miller with the Oregon State Police Boxing and Wrestling Commission is in attendance and will be submitting a testimony, I believe, and he can, I'm sure, answer some questions.
He might be able to address that. Okay. Representative Kitts, did you have a question?
I've got one quick question. If we leave in wrestling under the commission, boxing and wrestling commission, I guess I don't see the need to do that or understand why we would do that if we're saying that wrestling in this situation, wrestling, is sports entertainment. Why do we need them, period, to...
Well...
Go ahead.
Chair Kremel, Representative Kitts, I am assuming here that there is still wrestling being conducted for sport in this state. What I am addressing is entertainment wrestling, not sport wrestling. That is why.
Okay.
Patrick? I can clarify. I think it was touched on earlier. There is another brand of sport that's semi-defined as wrestling called Ultimate Fighting. Maybe you've heard of it. And that, I believe, would still be regulated as wrestling by the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. And that's why it would remain, because it would still regulate Ultimate Fighting wrestling, but they wouldn't regulate entertainment wrestling.
Great.
Representative Kitts, if I may, I may be able to shed some light on your question. In working with the committee on the legislation, as I have done in so many states that have deregulated, one of the concerns that we had, as well as the representative's staff, was that if you were to take entertainment wrestling out in its entirety, it could lead to some rogue organization trying to create an event calling it entertainment wrestling with not having any type of control over them, not having qualified wrestlers. So what we've done in several of the states is said, look, to ensure the integrity of the promotion coming in, and to give the state the opportunity, or the commission the opportunity, to say, look, you know, this is a backyard wrestling organization coming in saying that we are an entertainment wrestling, you know, doing entertainment wrestling. This gives the commission the opportunity of saying, look, we have looked at what your product is. We do not believe that you fall within the definition of entertainment wrestling, and we're therefore not going to give you a promoter's license. It was, again, in working with the committee, was to protect the interests not only of the of us, represent the interest of the Boxing Wrestling Commission, but represent the interest of safety, to make sure that what is coming in under those guys is actually an entertainment wrestling event and not something fly by night. So it's a protective measure.
Okay, great. We have with us Senator Margaret Carter. And Senator Carter, welcome to House General Government. And we are talking about House Bill 3581, which I understand you have an interest in.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to all of you. I'm Margaret Carter, House District 22, North Northeast Portland. With me comes ambiance, Mr. Chairman. Yay, go wrestling! And, Mr. Chairman, I don't want you to forget, we're talking economic development and we're talking entertainment. I'm here on behalf of my grandkids and all the kids who love wrestling, and Margaret Carter, who loves wrestling, okay, even though I'm an old woman, but I love it. And they always try to prescribe who go to see wrestling. Well, I have a master's degree in education. I have kids who don't have a degree. I have grandkids who have not graduated from high school, so I don't think that you can fulfill a prototype of who likes it and who does not like it. And so I'm urging you to deregulate wrestling. And if you don't, whatever you're doing today, whether you give them a promoter's license or whatever, let's pass the bill. Wrestling in our contemporary lives, as I said before, is entertainment, and wrestling presents opportunities for economic activity in the region. I have served on Economic Development Committee since 1987 in the House for 14 years, and now since I've been in the Senate on the Ways and Means Committee of Economic Development, I can't think of a better way for us to bring revenue into the state and at the same time give it give entertainment to those who like it. So I'm encouraging you to send House Bill 3581 over to the Senate so we can approve this legislation and have Oregon join the many other states that do not regulate wrestling. And again, I will temper that by the fact that you're talking promotion, which is commonly understood today as entertainment and recreation. And probably in the future, you'll see a bill coming back before you again that's saying, let's have wrestling in Oregon. Thank you. I stand available for any questions.
Thank you, Senator.
This morning.
Senator, are you aware of the amendments, the Dash 1 amendments?
I've been told by my staff, yes.
Okay, great. And now, since it actually states in here that the outcome is staged, you're not in any way trying to suggest that your testimony has been staged, are you?
Mr. Chairman, I am an entertainer. I sing, I speak, and I tell you I believe in free, you know, activity when it comes down to people expressing themselves. And so entertainment, wrestling, whatever.
Did you go to the Sam Brooks School of promotion?
He went to my school.
Oh, he went to your school. Representative Brzezinski and then Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, based on your comment, I guess I just have to ask, do you have any existing contracts with entertaining wrestling?
But I'm looking for someone. Where's your card?
I did see him flipping one over to Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carter, you know, I was brokenhearted today to learn that it isn't the real deal.
I know.
Because I was brought up on it in the panhandle. And my father, he's probably very disappointed today for us to have found this out. And I loved it. But, I'm just curious, do we bet on entertainment wrestling? Is there a betting process involved?
Not to my knowledge. I've been following wrestling ever since the days of one of very...
Oregon?
Yes, since the 1967. One of my great wrestling people who's no longer with us is Shag Thomas from my district. And his family and all of us were good friends. And we used to live out in North Portland where they had the wrestling promotions. And so the kids would always, on Saturday nights or something, just stand around outside seeing the big wrestlers come in. They would always say hi to the kids, and I mean it is a form of entertainment within itself, and the guys are reachable as role models to some of the kids in terms of sports and that kind of stuff, and I think that even if there are staging moments, I think that there should be, and I think that there is a precursor to all this stuff, because they say kids don't try this at home, and I think those are the kind of safety measures that we can put into place so that kids will hopefully not try to mimic. But they mimic soldiers in war. They mimic all the entertainers who wear their pants down below their butts in society today. And we try to do whatever kind of precautions we can. I think that I don't think wrestling should be one that is precluded from doing this.
First time Mike could hit somebody with a metal chair, I'm going to give you a call, Senator.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much, Senator. And let me go ahead and have you all stand down. I've got Representative Kitts and Bob Miller, and let me just have you both come up together, if I may, please. Senator, thank you very much for coming in and entertaining us. Representative Kitts, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that you found a way to definitely keep me in committee, and that's scheduling two of my bills and allowing me to testify on the other. I appreciate the opportunity. For the record, again, my name is Derek Kitts, State Representative, House District 30. I was glad to see on this bill that I was glad to see on this bill that Representative Avakian was a co-sponsor. I would have liked to have been a co-sponsor myself of this bill.
We can still add your name.
Yeah, I would very much appreciate that. As an individual that's wrestled for 17 years, and I know that Representative Avakian was a college wrestler like myself, this bill appears to those of us that participate in the sport, not the entertainment of wrestling, as a no-brainer. And I would urge the chair, and I realize that these individuals that participate in this entertainment are great athletes. But I can tell you that as a college and high school and middle school wrestler, we would definitely appreciate the distinction between sports entertainment and sport. So that being said, I would support the abolishing of the entire wrestling commission, although they're not willing to go that far, and that's fine. I would urge the committee support and passage of this. I know that I will be supporting it, and I can speak on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of wrestlers in the state of Oregon, who is very rich in tradition with also real wrestling as well. Pardon me. So, again, for the record, I would like to say that I do support this bill, and on behalf of those hundreds of thousands of youth and college wrestlers out there, I'm sure that we would also appreciate the distinction between wrestling and wrestling. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Miller. I'm the director of the Gaming Enforcement Division for the Oregon State Police. I've got the Tribal Gaming Lottery Security and the Oregon Boxing Wrestling Commission. This has already been kind of also a high school and collegiate wrestler. So this has been a little bit of a fascination, this association I've had with the commission for the last 6 years. I have looked at the legislative history of the Boxing Wrestling Commission that this body created in 1987, and I looked at some of the momentum behind creating the commission. And it'll probably come as no surprise to the committee that the legislature knew in 1987 that wrestling was fake. But because of some of the concerns that they had about some of the possibility of other things occurring, they decided to regulate it. And the commission has regulated or recognized for some time that entertainment wrestling probably did need to be handled in a different manner. And in fact, there were some rulemaking things in the works when this bill was dropped. But I think this bill has been an excellent catalyst for bringing about that change and getting the public policy guidance from this body that the commission needs to do their job. Part of the reason there's been that issue is because the commission's been getting conflicting input. We've had two professional wrestlers on the commission. I had occasion to talk to Moondog Moretti just a couple of weeks ago, and he was one of the proponents of saying, no, wrestling's fake, but it needs to be regulated. And so what we found ourselves in a position was you had wrestlers saying that it needed to be regulated and promoters saying that it didn't. And through a process of time, what you have today that you didn't have in 1987 is that you have consensus. You have the industry, you have the wrestlers, you have the commission, you have your constituency saying entertainment wrestling should be treated differently. The commission agrees with that. I was just given the Dash 1 amendments this morning. I reviewed them, barring some legal technicality that our attorney might bring to our attention, is certainly within the spirit of what the commission has empowered me to agree to, and it's in line with the superintendent of state's police role to statutory role. One of the stumbling blocks over the last several years has been the public health issue. There is one distinction between this form of entertainment and theater. The blood you see on television, the blood you see at the arena is real blood. These guys actually hit each other. These guys actually cause injury occasionally. A lot of it's from scar tissue, but it's real blood. The physician member of the commission has taken a while to get to a point where he could, in good conscience, deal with the public health issue. The amendments that you have and the requirement on the promotion to make that declaration, and I agree with WWE, we've been working with them as well. They have a vested interest in ensuring that their entertainers are disease-free. And so having said all of that, both the state police and the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission support the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3581 as offered to you today.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kitts?
I just want to clarify for the committee that the reason that I would support abolishing the wrestling commission per se is because we can all agree that it's entertainment. Okay, it's not sport per se. When I say that, we know the outcome. I have a hard time with having a wrestling commission because you have anywhere, boxing I understand, you can have prize fights. There is no such thing as professional real wrestling. There is no, if I engage in a contest where we both weigh in at 7 o'clock and compete at 7 o'clock the next day and we don't know the outcome, there is no case at any level for professional paid wrestling. It's not staged. And that's why I have a problem with putting my sport in that commission category, because we don't have a commission for, well, everything else has professional stuff. I mean, it'd be like professional swimming commission or professional water ballet, and that's where I have the problem. So I don't want, I think the commission's done, I have nothing against the commission, as for the record. So.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Miller. I was trying to get some information from the chair here, who's much smarter than I am. It seems like this bill should say entertainment wrestling versus sport wrestling, and we just say extreme fighting and wrestling. So this is going to bother me forever, and it make it very difficult to vote on this bill because I have sons and relatives who have wrestled their lives. So it seems like that other word needs to be in here, and I don't see it anywhere. It can be very confusing. But how do you impact the Native American wrestling, boxing activities? Or does it come up, does state law preempt what they do or have nothing to do with it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, as it pertains to the nine sovereign nations that we have within Oregon, the tribal nations, Oregon state law does not apply on sovereign lands. Federal law does not apply on federal lands unless the law specifically states that it applies to sovereign nations. So anything that we do statutorily, for example, Oregon Revised Statutes 463 does not apply to tribal lands. Now we do, we have an intergovernmental agreement with the Cow Creek tribe that we co-sponsor their professional boxing shows, the state commission and the tribal commission. The Siletz tribe, we do not have that agreement, and they've had HBO fights. They could have WWE over there anytime they want to, and it would not come under state regulation. Now there is a federal law that requires, and this is a reference, federal law does not apply to Indian tribes unless it specifically says so. There is a Professional Sports Act that covers professional boxing, and so the Siletz tribe has their own boxing commission that has to meet or exceed the state's commission.
Question, and do we have jurisdiction over betting, wagering at entertainment wrestling events?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, it's interesting, as I've had this debate, I believe, here in 1999, one of the distinctions that I made was, and we're not idiots. We recognize that this isn't a sport. And the big distinction that is drawn is that nobody will give you odds on a WWE fight. You can go to Las Vegas. You can bet on about anything you want to. But, yeah, you won't be betting on professional wrestling.
Kind of like betting on a John Wayne movie, isn't it?
Yeah. The guy in the big hat's going to win, right? Okay, great. Thank you very much. Bob, appreciate you being here. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3581? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3581. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3581. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the House approve and accept
House Bill 3581 and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Well, Mr. Representative, I need you to move the dash ones first.
Let me back up. Thank you.
Yes, you may back
That's
up.
That's an excellent suggestion.
I think so.
I would
move considering it doesn't stand a prayer otherwise.
I would move that we accept the dash one amendment to House Bill 3581.
Representative Kitts has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 3581. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Kitts.
Chair, I would move that the Committee on General Government accept House Bill 3581 as amended and move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3581 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
And comment?
Yes, this would be the appropriate time, Representative Mabry.
This morning has just cleared up one of the ancient mysteries I've had. When the good guy was in a head hold, they could twist his head off, and he wouldn't fall down. But if the bad guy tugged on his trunks, he fell flat on his back. And now I understand that. Very educational moment.
He just had to be careful how he tugged on his trunks, didn't he? any other comments? The only point I would make is that as an old wrestling coach, well, let me rephrase that, as a former wrestling coach.
Chair, you
what
right
kind of wrestling?
Collegiate wrestling.
Oh, okay.
The real stuff. I guess, sort of contest the statement or the definition as being with the possible effect of rendering the opponent unable to continue the contest. That seems a little bit barbaric. But anyway, but wrestling can be a barbaric sport anyway. Gina, you want to call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3581, having received the constitutional majority, is passed and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Tootie Smith and Representative Kitts, would you be co-carriers, please? Thank you very much. And we'll put Representative Smith up first. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3581. Thank you, committee. Let's move into then I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3530. Patrick, you want to give us a rundown on this one, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3530 clarifies that a majority of an annexation vote means a majority of the combined votes cast by the electors of the city or district and the electors of the territory proposed to be annexed.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. We have Linda Ludwig and Burton Wiest. Can I have the two of you come up together, please? Good morning and welcome to General Government. I hope it's been entertaining for you this morning.
It has.
Whichever one of you wants to go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Burton Wiest. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, which, as you hopefully know, includes the 26 different kinds of special districts in Oregon, ranging from fire districts, as we previously discussed, to water, sanitary, irrigation, park and recreation, and so forth types of special districts in Oregon. We're here in support of House Bill 3530, and what I wanted to do is give you a very brief history on ORS 195, which is the chapter that this bill amends. Back in the early 90s, when it became pretty apparent in Oregon that growth and economic development in those happy days was returning to Oregon and we were getting more and more development applications, Governor Roberts and the Land Conservation Development Commission decided it was time to look at the land use statutes and laws to determine if there were things that the laws were doing or not doing to hinder or impede development within urban growth boundaries. And one of and a commission or a several committees and work groups were set up, and one of the work groups, which I was on, along with the then mayor of Beaverton and several other local officials and home builder developer interests, was to look at the difficulty that many people were having with defining who their service provider operator was within an urban growth boundary. And unfortunately, in those days, it was fairly common that a property owner or developer or commercial industrial developer would go and seek a permit and find that, well, it was in the territory of a city, but it was provided by a special district, but the city might withdraw the service from the special district, or the special district was considering annexing the city to provide that service, and it made it very difficult for people to plan for developments. So our subcommittee worked on that issue, and the recommendation of that subcommittee became a Senate bill, Senate Bill 122, which was introduced at the request of Governor Roberts in the 1993 legislature. And that bill passed, and my recollection is, unanimously. If it had any no votes at all, it might have been one, but my recollection is the bill passed unanimously. What ORS 195, which was a new chapter that was created as a result of that bill dealing with planning coordination, did is it required cities, counties, and special districts to enter into what are called urban service agreements that run 20-year periods of time, and to resolve those issues so that property owners and industries would not have to get themselves in the middle of fistfights, frankly, between local governments on who was doing what to whom. So this requirement was established, and it was done as part of the periodic review process. So as local governments have come up in periodic review through LCDC, they are required, and that's currently being done, they are required to adopt these urban service, or as we shorthand them, call them Senate Bill 122 agreements. And that is being done. Some recent examples of those, a very successful example is Washington County. Washington County as Representative Avakian knows, Washington County has some very large service districts. Tuolumne Valley Fire and Rescue, the Clean Water Agency, and others. And these very large service districts have concluded agreements with the cities in the county and with the county. And it is now clear who provides what service, who will annex in the future, what territories will be done. And these agreements, in some cases, are very complex and involve, in this case, Hillsborough actually paying a park district for parklands that they intend to develop when they annex into the park district. So the long and short of it is that this whole chapter was created to deal with a specific problem, and in the view of special districts, and I think I can say cities and counties, where this has been applied through periodic review, it's been a very successful product. A key provision of this was that once all these agreements are signed, and these agreements are done in public. I mean, these are publicly adopted agreements between all the various agencies. When everyone has signed off, the cities, the districts, and the counties, everybody has agreed on who's going to serve what territory. A key provision is to allow a vote to be held, to allow annexations to be done at council meetings or board meetings without going through the normal annexation procedure. Why is this necessary? If we've established who is going to provide what service, that doesn't alleviate the statutory requirement for individual series of annexations going through the annexation process, and what can lead up to, in an area the size of Washington County, keep using them as the example, literally dozens of elections and dozens of votes to implement a plan that everyone has agreed on. So a key provision of Senate Bill 122 was to allow an annexation plan that has been approved by all the parties to be placed on the ballot, and then all the parties vote on that. All the affected voters vote on it, and then that vote, if approved, allows the individual local governments to do their annexations by resolution or at individual council meetings and not go through the standard annexation process. This was done to provide certainty for industrial developers, provide certainty for landowners, so that they knew when they would get services and they knew that it would be done in an orderly fashion. Special districts in particular have a long history of supporting votes and people, property owners, having the right to vote, but we wholeheartedly support that process in ORS 195. Since then, there has been a couple court decisions, and I'll let Linda talk about, that makes this clarification necessary. The bill before you, 3520, does not change the law in any way. In our view, we think it just makes it a little bit clearer about who votes when an annexation plan is put on the ballot. So with that introduction, Mr. Chair, give it to Linda.
And let me interrupt you just for a second here, Linda. And you did mean 3530.
I'm sorry, I said 20. I'm sorry, 3530. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I just want to make sure that you're not justifying on the wrong bill.
You're having to watch us all today. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities, and very much appreciate Burton Weiss' historical knowledge and background with this issue. And yes, I did put the bill right here in front of him so he could see the number.
Remember the number.
Where are we today? Let me tell you a little bit about the city of LeGrand. Many cities, several of our cities, including LeGrand, strongly support House Bill 3530. Again, the bill doesn't change current statutory policy, but it does provide the clarification of the voting requirement for only urban service annexations. Annexations of urbanized areas have become increasingly important to the economic vitality of our cities in Oregon. Cities like LeGrand provide services to residents in urban growth areas, but oftentimes they are unable to recover those costs. LeGrand, for instance, started providing services to properties adjacent to the city's boundaries about 30 years ago. At that time, the property owners signed agreements that they would agree to annex at a future date in exchange for those services. Those agreements were simple contracts. The city collected enough of them through the years to justify the annexation of about 150 properties, which they tried to move forward with in 1998. That annexation plan was challenged by a single property owner and overturned by LUBA because of an obscure court case that found that some of the cities that had filed those agreements pre-1991 needed different kinds of criteria. So LeGrand would very much like to continue to run through this annexation plan and process again. But right now, where they are, this has left the city with areas that are fully developed, but some of those areas are paying no city property tax for their services. And in LeGrand, it's particularly striking because they have people on one side of the street that are paying city property taxes at a rate of about $7.50 per thousand, while on the other side, literally that other side of the street, there are residents receiving those same services that are paying no taxes. So again, LeGrand right now is in the process of developing an annexation plan and have renewed some of those agreements that they found they were in error with, want to take it through the hearings process and vote a second time. And the price tag on these annexations is not inexpensive. The second time around for LeGrand is going to cost them approximately $50,000. Ultimately, in many jurisdictions, as in LeGrand, this is really an equity issue. That demands an equity solution for taxpayers who receive those services. The clarifying language by adding the word combined in House Bill 3530 would very much help LeGrand and other cities utilize the tool of urban service provider annexations without overriding the process concern of misrepresentation of the existing language, adding to the fiscal and political costs of unnecessary appeals. A couple of last thoughts. You're going to likely hear some concerns about annexation without appropriate representation. This has very much encouraged several of our cities in the state to pass voter-required annexation charter amendments. About 30 cities in the state have currently passed those of 238 cities. That has been over the course of the last 25 years. The type of annexation that we're talking about today, urban service provider annexation, does require a vote. It does require a vote on that annexation plan. These kinds of annexations, as you heard from Mr. Wiest, differ from other types of annexations in cities because the cities and districts must jump through many hoops of completing their urban service agreements and developing that plan in conjunction with their other jurisdictions prior to that annexation. This is a time-consuming plan process. It is a very planning-rich process involving many, many public hearings and involving written findings. and oftentimes involving property owners that are already receiving their services. Because of this, that voting requirement in this type of annexation was intentionally different in the legislation that was passed in 1993.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for either one of our speakers? Representative Nelson?
Just one quick question. Out of all the cities, Linda, how many cities have agreed with this?
It has bill 3530. Uh-huh. We do have all our cities supporting this, as I have known. 238 cities. 38. I have not heard of any opposition to this bill.
Thanks.
Burton, earlier the earlier bill that we did that was relative to Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and City of West Lynn, this won't have any kind of an effect on that bill, I presume.
No, Chair Carmel. That is a traditional type of annexation where you have a single district or city trying to annex a particular area. And no, this got to be real clear here because this annexation is extremely complicated. I think there's five different ways to annex in Oregon. This annexation only applies in a very narrow circumstance, and that is when urban service agreements have been agreed to, an annexation plan has been adopted, and it's been put on the ballot by all the jurisdictions at one time.
Okay. One other thing is that I was reading City of LeGrand's letter. So if the people basically have decided that they won't agree to being annexed, can't the city say, since they're outside the city limits, that they can determine not to serve them and turn off the services?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they do actually have that option, and the city has decided not to take that option, even though there is a fiscal expense to providing those services.
Are they exercising their right to charge more for the services since they're outside the urban, since they're outside the city limits, as opposed to what city residents normally pay?
Mr. Chair, I'm uncertain if the rates differ, whether or not they are inside the city limits or not.
Okay. Since the city does have that right, when they're providing services outside of their city limits, they do have the right to charge, I believe it's double what they charge property owners inside the city.
And I very much would like to say that the City of LeGrand would have liked to have been here for the hearing today, but could not attend.
Okay. Thank you. We have Jerry Ritter signed up for this bill also.
With all the wrestlers here, I'm going to have to be careful what I say. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Ritter. I'm here representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations. So we are a coalition of citizen groups in the 30 cities that was just mentioned who have passed the bill or annexation agreements. And our mission is to promote and protect citizen involvement in land use issues, primarily those involving annexations. OCVA strongly opposes House Bill 3530, and the reason we oppose it is because it would cast in stone one provision of the statute of ORS 195, Section 205. It would cast that in stone, and that provision has been rightly called grossly unfair. We probably have more experience with 195 than any citizens group. Even so, our experience, like that of everyone else's, is very limited because, to our knowledge, and this question came up earlier, I believe, only one city has taken the ORS 195 annexation procedure to its full conclusion. Now, we've been involved in several other cities, LeGrand among them, who have considered the law and or gone through partly its processes. But to our knowledge, only Bend went through the process in its entirety when it annexed its UGB in 1999. So given the very limited use of 195, you might ask, well, why are we so concerned about it? We're concerned about it because there are two fundamental flaws in ORS 195, one of which this bill seeks to solidify. The history has already been discussed. 195 was passed as Senate Bill 122 back in the 93 session, and it includes an annexation plan whereby the urban service agreements and intergovernmental agreements are entered into so that it's known who's going to provide what services to whom and when. All in all, so far, so good. With all due respect to the previous speakers, I can tell you that this stuff happens out of the public eye. There aren't all these public hearings. The plan is put together, and unless the public meticulously follow city government and their actions, they don't know about it until the plan is a done deal as far as the city is concerned. It's only after the plan is fully developed that public hearings are held, if they're even held at all. And by then, the city considers the plan, as I said, a done deal. Then the plan is put up for a vote, as you heard, and that's the process we're dealing with today. The existing language of Section 205 states that the city or the governing body, and I quote, shall cause the annexation plan to be submitted to the electors of the city or district and to the electors of the territory proposed to be annexed. This language is unclear as to whether this should be a combined vote or a double majority. The League of Oregon Cities and all cities who have either used it or considered using it have gone with a combined vote interpretation. Legislators we spoke with who were involved in the 122 vote could not tell us what the intent of the language is, and that's why we have two diametrically opposed bills in this session, this one and 3211 over in environment and land use. The combined vote provision is a second flaw in the process because it effectively denies those who are most impacted by the annexation a voice in the process. That's because the population in the city dwarfs the population in the area slated for annexation. In the Bend example, the Bend UGB residents voted 3-1 against the proposal, but they were overwhelmed by the city residents who voted 3-1 in favor, so they effectively had no voice in the process. It was this flaw that prompted the Lane County Commission back in 1994 by a 4-1 margin to refuse to agree to an ORS 195 annexation plan. City of Springfield at the time was considering 195 as a possible way to annex the UGB. Then Commissioner Steve Kornacki called the combined vote interpretation grossly unfair. House Bill 3530 would mandate the combined vote interpretation, and that's why we oppose it. It's why we support 3211 to mandate the double majority interpretation. Ladies and gentlemen, the very purpose of a vote is to give people a voice. The combined vote interpretation denies those most impacted by an annexation a voice. It is indeed grossly unfair. It should not be cast in stone. Now, the League and development interests have argued and will continue to argue that using a double majority interpretation will greatly complicate matters. But given the very limited use of this law, that argument would appear to have little merit. And as a UGB resident, I can also tell you that also of little merit is the argument that UGB residents do not pay for city services. That's nonsense. I live in the Springfield UGB. We contract with the city. We pay fire service rates through the city, the same as city residents. We are protected by the Lane County Sheriff. We pay for road fees. We pay a water district for water fees. We pay for our services. LeGrand pays for its services. This is an argument that cities who have considered this law always use, and I find it very objectionable. This is a classic case of fairness versus expediency for city governments. And I would urge you to come down on the side of fairness in this issue and lay this bill to rest. And I'll be happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for... I do have one. What about the agreements that are in place? For example, the city of LeGrand, if they have agreements that are in place, I guess my first question is, shouldn't those be honored? And my second question is, are agreements like this recorded? You may not know the answer to that. In other words, recorded with the property.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I can directly answer that question, but we believe we're not asking that ORS 195 Section 205 be eliminated. We just ask that the voting provision go ahead as scheduled, but scheduled as a double majority vote, in that the city and the territory slated for annexation each vote, but each vote separately.
Mm-hmm.
So that the annexation occurs when both sides and both parties, when it's worthwhile for both of them to have it happen.
Okay. Would you then also support the notion that if an area that it has an agreement then decides or refuses to be annexed, that the services be shut off?
Mr. Chairman, I have no problem with that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jerry, I want to make sure, knowing Lane County and knowing what's happened up on the Santa Clara area, and I'm not real familiar. I know that in River Road areas the decisions that septic tanks weren't going to complete but provide the services that were necessary. This came in. And I'm just trying to wrestle with the issues of where there, as the chair has brought up, if there's actually an agreement, written agreements that have been signed by the landowner and the city, help me understand the position that your organization would be taking as to if everyone's on board that there is going to be an annexation occurring at some point in the future. When, at this point, is it your position or your organization's position that it's believed the city is the one that's pushing that date as to without any other agreements from the affected landowners? I'm just trying to figure out the double majority is going to, it sounds like it may actually provide an opportunity for individuals to, let's say, not honor the agreements that they've already entered into. And I'm trying to figure out how does that work in your concept to make them certain that is fair, yet at the same time people honor the agreements that they've entered into?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, there's several issues on the question on the River Road and the septic tank issue. That would, if it's a health matter like that, I believe it falls under ORS 222, which is a state-mandated annexation that this process would have no impact on because it's a different regulation that it happens under. As far as individual property owners who have signed annexation agreements, we would not suggest that those be abrogated. Where we have a problem with the use of this law is when a city goes after its entire UGB in one fell swoop, where you have a very large population in a city that goes after a smaller population, not individual properties per se. With the individual property owner who signs an annexation agreement, we have no issue with that being enforced. Does that answer your question, sir?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Nelson, you have a question?
Yes, sir. Would it be possible to ask a question of Linda?
Well, anything's possible.
I have no problem with that.
Linda, come on up, if you would, please. While she's coming up, I do appreciate the committee's indulgence, and we will quickly move through here as fast as we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda, I'm just wondering, is there any compromise in this bill between the two of you sitting there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I'm not sure there is a compromise position in that all 3530 was trying to do is just clarify what we believe is the current policy regarding how that vote is calculated. We, the League and the City of Rio Grande and all, would not care to move towards a double majority calculation at this time. That would be a significant change in current policy.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Reeder, follow up. Mr. Ritter, would there be any compromise that you could get together?
We're always willing to compromise, but our mission is to give the people most impacted a voice, and the current interpretation and current policy does not.
So your and your feeling would be then that if you went with a double majority, that if the people being annexed voted the majority voted no, and the people annexing voted majority voted yes, then the measure would fail.
That is correct, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative Avakian.
Ms. Lovick, why did the cities oppose the double majority?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, you have to remember that this is a very extraordinarily different type of annexation than any of the other types of annexation that cities do. We have these urban service agreements in place. This is a very, very public process. In many instances, such as LeGrand, property owners have already signed written contracts that they are going to support the annexation. Very, very different different type of circumstance than the other types of circumstances where cities traditionally bring in territory where we are obligated to the double majority vote. And we do that and honor that. This is just a very different type of annexation process.
Representative Krasinski?
Mr. Chair, I'm having a lot of confusion on the bill in the sense of the different types of annexations. I'm just not up to speed on everything, so please bear with me. Linda, I guess if you have an area such as LeGrand where some of the individual property owners have actually entered into these agreements, there seems to be an ability to have some type of enforcement to have them being annexed, and based on their prior acknowledgement, they're willing to do that, based on getting the services, I assume. So then there's other individuals who the city has decided to provide services to because they're in that same general area, but they don't have these agreements. Is that a fair understanding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski, I wish that I was an expert on exactly what the circumstances in LeGrand are, and I am not.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to maybe have the city, League of Cities, come by the office and start taking everyone else's time and give me a briefing on this because I need some help with this one.
I think that would be a good idea, and I'm going to hold off on going into a work session on this bill because I think there are some issues that need to be clarified in understanding with regards to when urban service agreements are actually in place and you know this kind of a rare sort of a situation of what you're trying to accomplish. But I will tell you that and having been in local government that if I were in a position in the city and folks that had signed on to an agreement refused to honor it, that I'd shut off the services. And that would then take care of the problem. The other thing is that I don't know, Linda, do you know, are these agreements generally recorded with the property?
Mr. Chair, to the best of my knowledge, they are not.
That might be something that we might want to add into the bill. Would be, and we could either do that in a work session on this side or on the Senate side if this bill were to move forward, but or put in to the other bill that Mr. Ritter was promoting, 3211, I think.
Yes, sir.
Would be that urban service agreements then are recorded with the when those agreements are made, they're recorded with the property, and in that way, it would follow the property as opposed to the current owner. So. If you would kind of visit with us a little bit about some of the possibilities there, I'd appreciate it. Okay? Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3530. Committee, I'm going to just tap 3488 through. Representative Farr is ill, and so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3488. Public hearing on House Bill 3488. I want to go back up to the top of the agenda very quickly. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3162. And you will remember that this is the one dealing with the Hall of Fame. I know that there are some issues that folks have with this, but I think that rather than holding this bill up, we could potentially, I think it could be worked a little bit more on the Senate side with some of the concerns that folks had. So Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that House Bill 3162 move through this committee with due pass recommendation to the floor and be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts has moved House Bill 3162 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be placed on the consent calendar. Is there discussion? Object to the consent calendar?
Object base bill. I think just the principle, and Representative Kitts, this has nothing to do with the bill, but there are some things that have been raised in this bill as to making certain that facilities is on board, and the legislative administrators on board as to stuff. I just think that we need to be able to allow individuals to have conversations if they want to, and instead of putting on the consent calendar where it's going to get bumped potentially and then have to be rescheduled again for another hearing day or floor day, I'd like to have it just go to the floor in their normal fashion.
Okay. Okay.
If you're willing to change your amendment.
I would be willing to change my amendment, and I appreciate the representative's comments, and
want to have unanimous consent, so if that's what it takes, I'm more than willing to address.
Was that an excellent comment?
That was an excellent objection.
Okay, so just a second, Representative. So let me back up for just a second. And Representative Kitz is going to amend his motion that the that House Bill 3162 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and removing the part of the motion to take it to the consent calendar. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will support this bill only as a courtesy, but I really felt that we needed to answer the questions of what is state policy on space here and those sort of things that were not answered. And so I'm going to hope that we get an answer before we move further.
Okay. I appreciate your comments. Any other comments relative to this bill? I would just point out, Representative, and maybe you could schedule time to explain this to those of us that might need the clarification, but there is the question that Representative Nelson raises with regards to the state policy, which, quite frankly, Representative, state policy in this respect is going to be what we make it, because we are the legislature. And as long as you get 3116 and 1, then you have that taken care of.
Well, Mr. Chair.
And then there's also a question relative to that I think has been raised by Representative Brzezinski with regards to facilities and how they, some of the questions that they might have about it. Representative Kitz.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative Brzezinski and Representative Nelson, I would hope that you bring up these questions on the floor during discussion of this, and I will assure you that if you have any specific questions, and Representative Brzezinski, we spoke, if you get any questions that you might have about this bill to me before the floor vote, I will have them answered for you before the floor vote, and if not, feel free to ask them at the point of the floor vote, and I will have an answer for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson, did you have...
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say, I'm just wondering how many different halls of fame we can have in this Capitol. I mean, if we're starting with a president, and that's what I just wanted to see, that we have some policy on that. I don't know. And we don't have much room after all the visitors are here.
One issue that I sort of had made a note of, and that is history versus present day. And I think that's one of the things that is sort of missing in this, is that we're really, this is a present day sort of an issue with regards to high tech and how the role that it plays in the state currently. When we look at the pictures that are depicted in the Capitol, a lot of it has to do with history, which of course we grew out of an agrarian economy. But with that said, I would also note that when you go back to Washington D.C. and you go through the Capitol to back there, it does reflect both history and present day, and I think that's something to that's a point to be made. Representative Kitz.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to belabor the point, but I agree with Representative Nelson. I agree with yourself. I would also hope that some of the things that are depicted in this Capitol, such as timber and fishing, don't remain history and become part of the present day.
Good point. Good point. Okay, with that, there's no further discussion. Gina, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3162 has received the constitutional majority, has passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Kitz, will you carry it, please? Representative Kitz, will you carry it, please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3162, and there's not being anything else before us, we stand adjourned.
Okay.